Hey everyone, this is Brian from the Tennis IQ Podcast. Josh and I hope that you are enjoying the content and discussions that we put out week after week. If you'd like to support the podcast and help us to continue to produce quality episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/tennisiqpodcast/membership. Currently, we have three tiers of support: the fan level at $3 per month, the supporter level at $7 per month, and the champion level at $20 per month. Benefits of joining the Tennis IQ podcast community include episode transcripts, participation in book club discussions, and access to monthly masterclasses with me and Josh. For more on these benefits of support, head on over to our Patreon page at patreon.com/tennisiqpodcast/membership. Thank you so much. And now, on to the show.
And welcome to the Tennis IQ Podcast. I'm Josh Berger.
And I'm Brian Lomax. And on today's episode of the Tennis IQ Podcast, Josh and I will be speaking with Jan Muhlfeit. Jan is an executive coach and mental coach for athletes, as well as a best-selling author. He had a very successful 22-year career at Microsoft, in which he served in numerous executive positions, including as the chairman of Europe. Now, Jan works as a mental coach with Olympic athletes, as well as several young and promising Czech tennis players. In this very wide-ranging conversation that we have with Jan, we touch on things like purpose, acceptance, non-judgment, non-attachment, and we get into how Jan likes to work with his tennis players and his philosophy of coaching. We know that you are going to enjoy this very excellent conversation with Jan Muhlfeit.
Welcome, Jan. We are very excited to have Jan Muhlfeit joining us today, Jan Muhlfeit, joining us today on the Tennis
IQ. Don't worry, it's perfect pronunciation.
Welcome, Jan. Thank you.
Hi, guys. Thanks very much for having me. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think we wanted to start off, with a little bit just about your background in terms of, you know, how you got into the work that you do, and also a little bit about your interest and background with sports and with tennis.
Yeah, I was a professional tennis player till 20 years old. I played the junior league in, at that time, Czechoslovakia. Ivan Lendl was like 2 years older than me, or Miroslav Mečíš was 3 years younger than me. Those guys were there at that time. But then I decided to switch my career to the computer. So I studied computer engineering. I was still, playing tennis a little bit. I did many sports, but then at some point I joined Microsoft, where I spent 22 years working, even for 10 years with people like Bill Gates, and Steve Ballmer. And at the end of my career, I was for 8 years Microsoft president for Europe. I left Microsoft 2014, and at that time I thought I would coach, executives and, some companies and do some seminars, whatever. And then I started to coach. In fact, Olympic Games winner in modern pentathlon, David Svoboda, was my first, athlete. And then I was asked by the my dear friend, who is the chairman of Czech Olympic Games committee and also part of the International Olympic Games Committee. If I will do, Jiří Kejval asked me if I can work with the other, athletes from the other, sports, and I started to do it. So I'm like the mental coach for the Czech Olympic top team and do many sports. And among others, I coach also Jiří Lehečka, that's the, senior tennis player in the senior category, the junior category. Nikola Bartunková was a final in Wimbledon, and Max Mrva is like 16 years old. He was best in the category worldwide when he was 15 years old. So they are like promising, guys, right? So I really enjoy it. And I also, in addition to what I do still with the businesses and sport, I teach program for the kids. It's called Unlocking Children Potential. And we basically train more than 10,000 kids, or, revealing their talents and working with those talents and so on. Yeah.
So it's really interesting background, Jan, with the tennis piece, a successful business career, then getting into coaching, I guess beginning with executives, right? And now also working with athletes.
Exactly.
And I'm sure all of that, you know, all that background informs how you work with your athletes. So I guess from a coaching perspective and more centered on athletes and tennis players, could you give us a sense of what your coaching philosophy is and you know, what some of the things you really want to impart to these athletes so that they can, you know, be whatever their definition of successful is and improve?
Usually athletes are coming to me with some, you know, challenges, right? What you know, other challenges and so on. So we starting, you know, to work on those. Then I do a diagnostic test. It's called Strengths Finder from Gallup. I work with Gallup for more than 25 years, and Jim Clifton is chairman, is a good friend of mine, to understand what is the mindset of the tennis player or athlete or a soccer player or whatever. And then I coach them on the different situation. My coaching is around three big pillars of the mental toughness, right? I mean, I'm like, the roots of my coaching are sitting in the positive psychology. That's why I like your podcast, guys, you know. I was very much inspired when I was younger by people like Martin Seligman and others, you know, right? So when I wrote my first book, I wrote like four books. My first book, which is international bestseller, it's called Positive Leader. And it's basically, I'm talking about the fact that the best people in the world, whether they are from the business or sport, are those who can understand who they are, who can figure out what they want from their life, and who can make decisions to use who they are to, you know, figure out what they want, to achieve what they want, okay? So my, you know, mental coaching is around three pillars: body, breath, and the mind. Obviously, we're going always like deeply, but those are like three things mainly, like the body language, right breathing, different breathing techniques. You know, I was trained by you know, many other people, and then the mindset, visualization, you know, internal dialogue, how to overcome, you know, obstacles and so on, right? I was you know, coaching many people in the business, and people, when I joined sport, that was interesting. When I joined sport, a lot of coaches, sport coaches, were saying, "You are a great business guy, but you don't understand what is sport all about." And guys, you know, brains are the same in business, brains are the same in sport. So you can use a lot of experience from business into the sport. So I was like trained here in London, you know, 9 years ago. Now I'm the fellow at the Harvard, you know, Coaching Institute. And there's a lot of exchange of the experience with the other coaches, right? So that's in the nutshell what I do. Usually, because my athletes are traveling around the world, I have not only Czech athletes, now I have like six different countries, you know. At least from the six different countries. Usually we do it, you know, online, and it's between half an hour to, you know, 1 hour. For example, Jiří Lehečka, the tennis player who is now top 30, before, you know, we recorded this podcast, we had a discussion about his last tournament, what we should do in the next tournament in Stockholm, right? And he identified, I'll tell you what we do, okay. He needs to tell me what happened tennis-wise at the court, okay? I'm seeing some of the matches, and then he needs to be able to tell me what was happening with his mind. Otherwise, I'm not able to help. And it's the same with soccer players. I used to work with people like Patrick. She was the second best player in Bundesliga, you know, right? So this is it. And then we can, you know, work together, because for me, I'm very much inspired by people like, you know, Buddha, obviously, even though I'm not Buddhist and I'm not you know, religious person. But those were like Jesus Christ, Buddha. They were really people. They were thinking about the present moment, about suffering and stuff like that. And if you are not able to forget about the last ball, you start to suffer at the court. I mean, Novak Djokovic is talking very often about it, right? So there is a lot of stuff, I believe, we can learn from the past. I'm like technologist by profession, so I'm all hands for the technology, but we should not forget that our predecessors were very smart people, right? We can learn a lot from the past.
Absolutely. No, I think that you're bringing up a good point here. So I guess as you think about your past and you think about, you know, your work as a technologist at, you know, Microsoft and your work, you know, your past as an athlete, you know, how does that inform the work that you do today, you know, working mm-hmm. with working with athletes, working with people in business? How does that sort of inform that philosophy that you use with them?
What I learned as an athlete, especially in the tennis, there are a couple of things you can take from tennis to the real life. Number one, you are alone. Okay. You need to decide. And that's great because people are not defined by conditions. They are defined by their decisions. That's what I believe. So you are on your own in your life. People will help you, but it's your life and you need to decide about your life. So I was always deciding on my life, number one. Number two, you play till the last ball. In soccer, if you are winning 10-0, you know, you're probably winning. In tennis, it's not like that. So you play till the last ball, right? And then the time between the balls is as much as important as the time when you play the ball. So that's the same thing in real life. You need to have a good rest, right, to achieve some results. So, for example, I was able, a lot of people were afraid of the Bill Gates because they were saying he's tough and he's smart. I was always talking to him as an equal, you know. In some sense, he was smarter in, you know, coding, whatever. I was probably smarter in like opening new subsidiaries for Microsoft because I opened many of them. You know what I mean, right? Then I was really able to learn a lot how people work, how their brain works, and so on. Saying that, I was quite successful manager. I was 4 years in the row, best performing manager worldwide for Microsoft. But then, 12 years ago, I deeply failed. And I tell you why, because I made a huge mistake. I talk about time between the balls, right? But in business, I didn't do it, especially my mental energy. I was not able to renew my mental energy because my brain, physically, I was having a rest, but my brain was going like that. I was not sleeping enough and so on. So I was depressed. For 3 months, I stayed home. 3 months, I was in the mental hospital. But again, I was like, hey, should I suffer because of the past? Because I could go and say, oh, I got depression. I failed, you know, before I was a top manager and now I'm like failure. No, I didn't say that. I said, let's learn from the past, you know, right? That's what they call growth mindset. There's a lot of tennis players with a fixed mindset. If it's going very well, they are like, oh, that's perfect. Dopamine is going like that, right? But if it's not going well, dopamine goes down and they are giving up very easily. But if you concentrate on the process, excellence is a very different thing from perfectionism. Excellence is about being best version of yourself every day. I'm telling my players, every evening, go and remind yourself what was going well, remind what was going well, repair what was not going well, because we are learning mostly from mistakes. If you are making mistakes, your brain will generate like peak of the neuroadrenaline, which is saying, this is important, you need to remember it, okay? So remind, repair, and imagine how you will do it in the future, right? And this is the way, you know, how you basically accept whatever happened in the past, accept it, move on, right? Because success is not about elevator, guys. Success is about the stairs, right? You go, you know, sometimes. So this is it. So I really learned a lot from depression, especially after depression, because I remember everything, number one. The guy who was my, you know, doctor, Professor Heschel, is a very good friend of mine. He was at that time president of the Psychiatric Association in Europe. So we are always talking now together, what happened, you know, he's giving me some feedback, whatever. And it's a great learning. Because if you know, you are losing some important matches, like in the final of the Wimbledon, I'm not saying everybody is depressed, but you can be depressed, right? You know, Mike Phelps, who got, I don't know, 26 or 28 golden medals, he was quite often depressed after the Olympic Games. right? So, and I believe we need to train people and, you know, players in tennis, because tennis is like mental chess, okay? It is a very tough game. And you are very close, you know, to win, and then you are losing. It's very tough. That's number one. Number two, when I was playing, the world was what I call linear still. Changes were linear. Now, changes are exponential. There's something in technology we call it Moore's Law. Every second year, there's a double of information is doubling. Your brain, guys, in 1 week now, needs to process as much information as the brains of our predecessors 100 years ago for the whole life. So the pressure on those players is huge, huge. Social networks, there is a lot of people sending a lot of hate, you know, emails and hate messages and so, you know, you see, so it is a tough, and I think we need to take mental health of the players. It's not only mental toughness, now I talk even about the mental health, very seriously, because it's a tough sport, you know. It's a mental sport, definitely. If you are like running marathon, it is still mental, but not that mental like tennis, right? So that's kind of the, in the nutshell, that, you know, experience. And I'm still, I'll be 62 very soon, and I still consider me to be like, you know, work in progress. I still learn a lot. I learn from your podcast a lot. As I told you, and I really mean it, you were the first podcast who went really deeply in the mental toughness topic for the tennis.
Well, thank you for that. Yeah, we appreciate that, Jan. Your story of your depression and the things that you learned, it reminded me, and maybe this is more spur of the moment, that life is actually like a tennis match, as you said, meaning, right, that a tennis match is not over until it's over. Your life is not over until it's over. So yes, of course, at 62, you're still a work in progress. At 55, I'm still a work in progress.
You look for like 40 years old, Brian.
your check is in the mail. Thank you. So, and I think, you know, we need to realize that, but one of the barriers that can get in the way of it, and this could be applied to your reflection exercise at the end of the day, because it's great to look at, all right, here are the things I did well. These are some of the things that maybe need work. Depends how you phrase it, because you could also be judgmental in that moment.
Oh, sure.
And I would like to get your perspective, because you also brought up Buddha and Buddhism and, you know, the concept of being non-judgmental and how important that is in a sport like tennis, in which during a match, you're losing probably almost every other point. Depending on where you are in the rankings, you're maybe 50% winning your matches. There's a lot of losing that goes on in tennis, and I'd love to hear your take on the importance of being non-judgmental.
This is, you know, absolutely essential. Why? Because your brain is pattern recognition machine. Your brain is predicting. If, for example, Jiří Lehecká is playing with Djokovic, right? And the ball is flying, so it is, in this sense, you know, the dominant sense are obviously the eyes. There's like the photo, if he's concentrated, if he's in the present moment, photo is compared with what is sitting already in his, you know, memory, and then he plays well. If he's not concentrated, if he's, for example, still judgmental about the ball before, it's overlapping only partially, and then he's making, you know, unforced errors, whatever, right? Now, related to the Buddha, let me do it. The major question for Buddha was like, how to achieve the fact not to suffer, right? And he was not fighting suffering around you. He was suffering. He was fighting suffering in you, because it is in the past, guys. Stress was basically triggered by the external events. Today, majority of the stress is happening here. It's your internal stress. That psychiatrist I named Cyril is telling me always that there is a less natural stress, you know, the natural danger for you, as opposed in the past. It's all created in your brain. Now, so the target was basically non-attached, not to be attached to the past. And not to be attached to the past, you need to be in the present moment. Now, the question is how to be in the present moment if your mind is wandering 70% of the time. Okay. The first thing, if you wanted to manage your mind, you need to follow your mind. Okay. You need to basically study what are your, you know, thoughts. For example, what I'm saying, you know, to my players, if you still have some repetitive, they call it sometimes ants, automatic negative thoughts. If you still have some ants in your brain, ask three questions. Is it logic? Is it, do I have any proof for it? And is it, you know, advantageous for me to think like that? If it's, the answer is not, it's the result of the amygdala thinking, you know, right? Your you know, emotional part of the brain. So you, in order to be in the present moment, you need to understand your thoughts, you know, right? Why it's so important to be in the present moment? Because only in the present moment, you can see reality. Because if you are judgmental, your brain is in the past. You are judging the past. You cannot judge the future. You can, but anyway. So if you are in the present moment, you can see reality. If you see reality, you will figure out that everything is changing. Some balls, as you rightly said, Brian, some balls are winning. Djokovic is winning 55% of the balls. He's, you know, losing 45. Come on, he needs to be ready for that, right? So if you see that everything is changing, you are not attached to anything and you can return back to the present moment. This is it. You know, non-attachment is a key, you know, non-judgmental. The problem is that our, you know, amygdala is 10 times faster, even more, than, you know, neocortex, than the logical part of the brain. It's always like, it's almost like professor against, you know, monkey, right? Professor wants you to win. Professor wants you, you know, to be successful. Professor can figure out what is true and what is not. The monkey goal is survival. Monkey does not care about your success. And if unfortunately you are still like in the last ball, then the monkey is working, you know. So this is it. If you think like logically, the last ball, which is done, makes absolutely no sense for the next ball. It's logical. But majority of the players don't think logically, you know, still. I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but you know what I mean, right?
Absolutely. And I think the comparison that you're making reminds me a little bit of The Inner Game of Tennis, the book, The Inner Game of Tennis.
Oh, yeah, that's a great book. By the way, in my first book, Positive Leader, Tim Galloway, we know each other, and he put some reference inside of the book. On the cover, I have a Deepak Chopra because we work a lot when I was in Microsoft. We work together a lot. So he's a nice guy. He's absolutely. I read The Inner Game of Golf. Inner Game of Tennis was the first one. There's a lot of, you know, stuff which is still useful today. That book must be almost like 50 years old, right?
It is. I think, pretty much exactly 50 years. And no, and he talks about, you know, sort of that self one and self two.
Absolutely. And the
sort of the supercomputer, you know, with our subconscious and, you know, that sort of critical, you know, self one where we're constantly thinking, constantly criticizing. And I think also that relates to what you're saying about thinking too much about the last point. And it really isn't logical because the last point's over.
No. You need to live your life, whatever is happening. You need to accept the past. Because if you are not accepting the past, you will build the mentality of the victim, basically. Okay. And you will start, hey, the wind is, you know, blowing, you know, the surface is not good, you know, my rockets are not, you know, ready, whatever, you know, right? And it's in you. Anyway, you need to play Djokovic. I mean, I like Novak because he's able to beat almost everybody with like 90% of his optimal performance. You need to play with the cards you have. It's like the cards, right? Nobody is like 100% all the time, but you need to be able to win even with your like 90%. Maybe you will suffer a little bit more at the court, you know, right? If it's not going that well, but this is it. But it's, I think it's tough. And I think Rafa is also great, like in forgetting the last ball, you know. So that's a.
Yeah. So Josh, I don't know if you've got your full question.
I think so. I mean, I was pretty much just saying, you know, when you were talking about sort of the monkey and the, you know, and the opposite of that, the professor, just sort of that being, yeah, that connection to, you know, Inner Game of Tennis and, and sort of that self one and self two, the doer and more the thinker. And I think the thinker sort of thinks back to the last point and is maybe critical.
Exactly. And it's interesting also to compare the notes with Kahneman, thinking slow and fast. You know, he is a Nobel Prize winner. Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. So what sort of, because we on this podcast, we've talked about a lot about that time in between points and what tennis players can do. What is the approach that, you know, whether it's somebody like Jiří Lehečka, the, you know, a top ATP player, or whether it's a junior player or somebody who's, you know, ranked lower or not at that level, what is sort of the approach that you take when it comes to that time in between points?
Yeah. Your breath and your body is always in the present moment. That's what you can use in your favor. The mind is, you know, wandering, right? So it is about how to fix your mind to your breath or to your body. So if it's between the balls, what you can do easily, if you are like a right hand, you know, player, you can put your racket in non-dominant, you know, hand, which is sending signal to your brain. Something, you know, finish and something new will start. Okay. So it's like they call it sometimes, you know, mental jingle. Like you put a mental jingle. Then breathe in, breathe out, concentrate on your breath. Because sometimes if you are, you know, scared, if you have a fear, then, you know, you are not breathing properly. And the breathing in, breathing out, it's like pulling you in the present moment. Then you can look at the center of your rocket and start to do those, you know, rituals and push that ball, you know, absolutely like outright. Don't think about it. Here, I think we are like 70% right already, but there are still 30% to work on, to be honest, you know, right? That for sure, you know, absolutely. Because now, look, I know how to move. He was like 2.5 years ago, 650. Now he's top 30. So I have some knowledge how to do it, but to be honest with you, I don't know yet how to move him to top 10. We are learning as we go, and I think we will do it, you know, right? Because he's hard work, he's working very hard. Because I do believe that, you know, to create like new synaptical connections and so on, it will take some time, you know, right? And this is it. So this is between the balls, and if you change the sides, basically, right? So what I'm telling them always, one bottle, the other bottle, then again, breathe in, breathe out, a couple of, you know, times. You can even do like legs release, right? Hands release, right? And you can basically, you know, push your mind to concentrate on your body and on the breathing. This is it. And then visualize the next point and go, right? Look, I can guarantee you, if I would ask even like top 50 players what they think about during the, you know, side exchange, majority of them, they would not be able to tell me. And it's so important, right? Because you have like 1 minute, you know, to regroup and do, you know, everything, right? I still do believe there is a great book, Power of Full Engagement, from Tony Schwartz and Jim Lohr. Tony Schwartz was teaching us in Microsoft. And I think they are absolutely right, because our predecessors, they were like hunting, heaven rest, and we need to use it, right? This is it. If you are like, you know, if you have two very tough games, you need to have a rest, and not only physical rest, but also mental rest. The other thing, guys, I'm recommending everybody to smile, right? Whatever is happening, because you release a lot of tension. You have 70 muscles in your face. And if you smile, you know, you have this, what they call it, there is some nerve which goes like from your head.
Vagus nerve.
Nervus vagus. And it's influencing a lot, you know, your nervosity or your calmness, you know, right? And if you smile, you can, you know, manage that nerve. Yeah,
absolutely. And I think the process you describe for the between point routine, between, you know, as you called it, the balls, really gets to something we want to do with all athletes, which is helping them manage their physiology. Yeah. And right, the breathing establishes some mental coherence. It begins to turn your brain back on. You talked about tuning into the body. That's the skill of active relaxation. And then setting an intention for the next point, whether that's visualization or not, you're giving them a positive focus. So those three things not only can be practiced between points, but you can practice those off the court.
All the time. Exactly. Right? All the time. You are spot on. And interestingly, in fact, today I was talking to Yire. I said, look, you are responsible for the game, obviously, but not for the all balls, because some balls are really, you know, tough to play. Okay. So you need to be, you know, to be control. But then you are responsible for the chemical battle on the court. And he was asking, what is the chemical battle? I said, that's all about hormones, about your body, breath, and your mind. This is it. Because your brain works like the huge chemical factory, right? You can lose, you can still feel like a winner, even though you are losing. Because look at what Djokovic, 2021 in French Open, he lost 6-0 to Rafa, and he was still walking like a lion, you know, because it is about right hormones. Because if you are like straight, your, you know, testosterone goes up by 20%, cortisol goes down by 25%. Body is very important, because the first language was not the language we talk, it was the body language. And that's why it's deeply in our subconscious. Right. So, yeah.
I think that absolutely makes sense. I know you've talked a lot about breathing, and, you know, I know you mentioned, you know, being able to sort of breathe through different parts of your body, breathe through your legs, through your arms. And you know, that's something we've talked about in terms of, you know, using progressive muscle relaxation and that sort of thing. Are there some other specific breathing techniques that you work on with players?
Yeah, I do a lot of, I follow Andrew Huberman work, the neuroscientist. You probably know he's one of the best guys in the world. It's amazing. And so what I do with athletes is yoga nidra, you know yoga nidra, right? Yeah, that's a great. Wim Hof, which is, you know, breathing and cold water. I was trained by Wim. Then we do breathing in the box. That's what the U.S. Navy is doing, you know, breathing in, hold, right, and breathing out, hold. And then the technique how to make more oxygen in your blood is like following you breathing on two, like breathing in and long breathing out, right? Because the thing is that hemoglobin is distributing oxygen in your blood. And hemoglobin needs to have an optimal level of the CO2. And if you go with your breathing out, like, that's not good. And that's what a lot of athletes are doing. It needs to be like breathing out should be like one third longer than breathing in. In fact, breathing out, people underestimate it's so much, so as much as important as the breathing in, you know, right? So you can really, I mean, if you watch small children, you know, the babies, they are breathing properly, absolutely, you know. By the way, that's another thing what I'm telling to some athletes with who are having the babies. I'm like, watch what the babies are doing. They are always 70-80% of the time, they are in the flow, they are in the zone, they are in the present moment. That's why they learn so fast, right? They are absolutely concentrated. They are not distracted by anything, right? And they learn to walk, whatever. That's one thing. And the other thing is, what is my experience? If the athletes are having, you know, some babies, usually they are like, okay, there are more important things in my life. It's not only tennis or football or whatever. And they are like cooling down, and it's usually a very positive impact on the game.
So let's talk perspectives, because that's where I wanted to go next anyway. You know, and so some of what Josh and I have discussed in the podcast relates back to the theory of constructed emotions. So Lisa Feldman Barrett, who's a neuroscientist here in Boston, right? And when we had Christina Rolo and Dave DeHaan on the podcast some time ago, they coached Victor Enescu. And they talked about their approach with Victor. And one of the perspectives that they used was that everything you do is practice. Like, you're wearing a Wimbledon shirt. Even playing Wimbledon is practice. So you know, and having that kind of perspective for some players can reduce pressure, but it can also help you process maybe a loss, you know, maybe some disappointing aspect of things, because you know you have something more to look forward to. I'm really curious to, you know, how you work with your athletes on things like perspective, how to look at difficult losses or failures, or if you even use the word failure, so that they can continue on that path of life, which, right, isn't over until it's over.
Yeah. I will give you one example, guys, but this is not from the tennis. It's from canoeing and from, you know, fencing. I have two guys, and they both, you know, Lucas Rohan won the silver medal in Tokyo, and Alex, who is a fencer, got bronze medal. And they were competing on Monday. And on Sunday, they were so stressed because they were afraid of the COVID test, because Japanese tests were much stronger than the European tests. Okay. So they were very stressed by that and stressed by the Olympic Games all together. So what we did, interesting exercise. We took the paper and I said, you put here the source of your stress, the source of your fear, which is like Olympic Games. And here, put like on one word, everything you achieve already in your life, okay? And what your brain does in such circumstances, it will go from negative zoom in to the positive zoom out. Mm-hmm. My dear friend, Dominic Hrbatý, who was number 12, you know, on the ATP tour, he told me that when 1 year, when it was not going, you know, very well, you know, he dropped in the ranking, he was using the word enjoy, which was like the center, you know, and he was like, enjoy your family, enjoy your life, enjoy what you achieve already, right? Because the amygdala, the problem with your monkey, with amygdala, she's fucking fast, sorry, forgive me my French, and she thinks always about the last negative experience, because amygdala wants you to survive. Amygdala doesn't want you to win, basically. And what is happening with athletes when they are like winning and suddenly it goes like, I must finish, and they are like impatient, amygdala will start like, you are like must, and amygdala will tell you, you should not lose, and then absolutely different, you know, hormones are released. It will start with the cortisol and you are usually losing, you know, right? Because you need to play the game to win, and the best way to win is really play one by one ball after the other. It's logical. The past is past. You cannot change the future in the future. You can change it here and now, one point after the other. But still, amygdala is, you know, amygdala is never in the present moment, by the way. She's always in the past or in the future, where, you know, it's basically amygdala is our stress, right? And the fears. And because on one side, you know, amygdala wants you to survive. On the other hand, our biggest fear, because if you want to survive, your biggest fear is fear to die. Yeah. And the problem, I tell you what, there is an interesting point on depression. Problem with amygdala is that amygdala originally was supposed to save our life. But if you are deeply depressed, what amygdala is doing, you are not able to think logically, that's gone. And amygdala is streaming all negativity. And it's unbearable, and that's why people are committing suicide. So in fact, that part of the brain, which is supposed to, you know, help you, it's against you, right? And that's why we have antidepressants and all the stuff, right? But this is it. So yeah, it is quite interesting. But I think what is important, number one, people should have, whether in the business or sport, they should have enough mental rest. A real mentalist, okay. And number two, if something is happening, they should go immediately visit, you know, some professionals. That's what I didn't do. For 3 months, I was at home. And then it was so bad that, you know, really bad.
I like that you're bringing up rest. And I know you mentioned, when we were talking about breathing, you mentioned yoga nidra, you know, non-sleep, deep rest. Yeah. And also, you know, I think for a lot of people, and maybe this was the case for you, you know, they, whether it's in a work context, whether it's in a tennis context and other sports, you know, but when people want to achieve a lot, they tend to really work hard at it. And that's great. And I think there's a lot of benefits to hard work, but I think that can go overboard and that can lead to burnout. And I think you bring up a really important point about rest. I wanted to go back to something that you mm-hmm. talked about earlier. And I think it's been an important piece of what you've been saying about, you know, being able to put the past behind you and be present, but also be able to learn from the past. And you know, especially, you know, with some of the life experience that you've had, how can you help athletes learn the difference between, I want to put the past behind me, but I also want to be able to learn from it. I want to be able to be present, but I also want to be able to apply some of the teachings and some of the lessons from the past. Yeah. You think you could talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Look, I have a lot of learnings from Bill Gates. Bill Gates was always telling me, Jan, if you don't know whether you should do it or not, just do it. You can always ask for forgiveness. That's number one, right? So that's number one. And it is. And number two, we were always doing, like we call it debriefing, you know, whatever. We were winning some deals, losing, always debrief. So you need to, whatever is happening, you are winning, losing. Both success and failure is leaving clues. And you need to study those clues to avoid it. Now, if it's, you know, failure, to repeat it, if it's, you know, winning, right? And there are three, in my view, there are three big questions you should ask, basically. What should I continue? What should I stop? And what should I start? I was just recently with some, you know, Polish soccer team. They won the Liga. And the coach was asking always those, you know, three questions after each and every match, giving them, you know, some feedback. And this is it, right? And we should not be like, hey, I lost and it's very bad, whatever. Yeah, you, I think Brian said that, you know, there's a lot of losing. In a sense, tennis is sport of the losers. Out of the 120 or 64 or 32, only one will win. I mean, I'm exaggerating, obviously, but this is it. Yeah. So you need to be ready. Tennis is, you know, it's nice sport, but very tough, you know, both physical and mental.
Yeah, no, it certainly is. You know, and one of the things that I think has come up maybe more recently, and I think, Jan, you were saying how, you know, it's become more and more difficult at the professional level. And this is true for all athletes, but it's becoming even truer for tennis players. We're hearing this in golf, is the idea of betting and gambling and its impact on players, whether that's receiving messages on social media or even, you know, in golf, a lot of players have been talking about hearing people in the gallery betting on whether they're going to, you know, hit the ball into the fairway or into the woods. And, you know, I think this is, you know, betting has become, and gambling has become more accepted even by professional sports, right? They're accepting sponsorships from companies because of the money, of course, right? And so I'm curious if this is something that you're finding as a challenge with some of your players being younger and getting better, because this happens even on the ITF tour that people will be betting. And, you know, it also has some potential mental health concerns.
Absolutely. In fact, there is a Czech player. I think she is 45 or whatever. Noskova is the name of the player. And she published 2 weeks ago, she published some harsh comments from Instagram or, you know, whatever, really bad comments. So I was asked by CNN Prima, which is like joint venture in Czech Republic between CNN and some local television. And I said, well, you know, number one, you can like switch off those comments, but then you are punishing also the good fans and you are losing, you know, sponsors, right? But I think the major thing, if we talk about this part of the issue, is that we need to make sure that, you know, social networks and including Microsoft like LinkedIn are much more transparent, okay? Because that this is it. Then, you know, betting, we should be very careful because it can be like a drugs for those, you know, people, right? And that's why they are writing what they are, you know, writing now that you can put, you know, the different name there, whatever. So I think it is about education, even in the schools, what can, you know, happen. It's like with alcohol and everything else. One or two glasses of wine is good. If you, you know, drink 3 liters, it's not good, right? So, but at what I would do, at least I would, you know, push those companies like, you know, but there's a very famous like Betamo and whatever in Europe to sponsor, you know, young athletes and kids and stuff like that. And that's what they do, right? It was always here, but when there was a paper economy, it was not that visible. Now everybody can do it, and the entry level is very low. You know, right? So I don't have an exact answer. I think it is about education, and also like ATP, WTA, ITF. It's in their hands. You know, whether they will work with them or not. You know, right? So there should be almost like some codex how people should behave, like, you know.
No, it's true, and I've seen like both of you were saying, I've seen a lot of ATP and WTA players who publish these things that are being sent to them, and it's right. Horrible. And I think it's, you know, there's definitely mental health concerns linked to that, but I think that there is more that, you know, and maybe this is a little bit off topic, but you know, I think there's more that social media companies could do, more that maybe the tours could do to prioritize that, especially now that we're in a stage where, you know, where mental health is understood better and is, you know, less stigmatized than in the past. And I think, you know, a lot of the professional tours, tennis and other professional sports are talking more about mental health, but just trying to understand the connection between betting, which has become bigger and bigger, especially in the U.S. I know there was a Supreme Court case that sort of opened things up a little bit, you know, in of just a few years ago, and mental health and trying to, you know, make sure that players are being protected, because, you know, as we all know, it's not just the Djokovic's and the Lehechka's and the top 20, top 50 players in the world here. It's, you know, there's the vast majority of tennis players play at the ITF level, play at the, you know, at the challenger level, futures, who are struggling to make ends meet. And they, you know, first of all, there can be corruption where people are maybe decide to, you know, to take a bribe and throw a match.
Yeah. I think it's exactly.
Mental health concerns. Absolutely. So I guess just wanted to add those points, but it's, I guess, have you seen, you know, in your work with professional players and with junior players, what have you seen to be some of the main factors that I guess that have both led to different mental health concerns, but also some of the things that have helped athletes who are going through different struggles?
Yeah. No, everybody should understand that we are, there's this discussion right now in psychology, whether there is a free choice or there is no free choice, because we are all programmed by our parents, you know, teachers, whatever, you know what I'm talking about, right? So you are influenced by, you know, your upbringing, right? So I think the parents are playing the key role, okay? That's why I tell you what I do. I'm like teaching kids, but also with the kids. I mean, in our seminar, there are parents, right? And there's a very open discussion with them. And majority of the kids are like doing some sports, whatever, because sometimes parents are, you know, too pushy, like pushing them, and they are scared to death. If I will not, you know, it's a faux pas, right? Fear of other people's opinion. No, the other people are like the parents even, right? Because the faux pas is basically in the past when you made some mistake and they push you out of that, you know, group, which was hunting, you know, you didn't survive. So we have deeply in our, you know, mind, in subconsciousness, if I will make some mistake, I may not survive. That's why we have a, you know, faux pas, right? So that's one thing. That's, the parents should be definitely, you know, reasonable, right? Coaches should be reasonable. That's another, you know, that's another thing, right? The very often, what is my experience, friend of mine, she is Katarina Neumann. She won Olympic Games in cross-country skiing in Italy 2006. And when she's, you know, coaching her daughter, she's like runner, you know, right? She's running 800 meters. She's never like too pushy or whatever, right? Because she achieved something. very often the parents, which were not, you know, athletes or whatever, are just pushing because they are almost like, hey, I have my trophy and there is another, you know, parent. Let's fight, you know. Especially in tennis, it goes like that. Sometimes. I'm not saying it's always, but sometimes. And it's not good. So we should work with the parents and really explain the kids. I'm able, because I'm teaching the kids from 8 years old. And I'm able, I mean, I have like soft toy monkey, and I'm able to explain them how the monkey works in the brain, right? If they have an exam, what they should do, how they should breathe and stuff like that. We should do it. Because I tell what is the issue in the childhood. We are teaching what is around them. We are not teaching them what is inside them. And we are still saying, people like Daniel Goleman and so on, that emotional intelligence is so important, like Lisa Feldman, right? That emotions are created. This is great work, but I'm even teaching at the, like in CEL, which is one of the best business university in the world. We are not teaching even like, you know, new executives, new CEOs, you know. And unless you, I think self-awareness is, if you are asking me, Josh, one thing what I would do, I would build much bigger self-awareness. That's why we are like testing those kids and helping them to understand who they are. Because if you understand who you are, you can figure out who are the other people, right? It can be your coach, your parents, but also your opponent. You can see, hey, you know, right? So this is, I think self-awareness is key and it's relatively low. You can play, it's called in tennis or in other sports, you are training type. During the training, you play like a hero. But then when you are under the mental pressure, it's not there. And I think it's because you don't understand. Because self-confidence starts with self-awareness. Okay. If you are self-aware, you know who you are. You know who you are not. Then the second point is self-confidence is about accepting the past, what happened in the past. Learn, as you Brian rightly said, learn from the past, both from the positive and negative experience. And then you are really like building and this kind of, hey, there is no, like Nelson Mandela was saying, I will, you know, win or I will learn. There's nothing else. And I think it's a key, if you switch like, hey, this is a failure, yeah, this is a learning. We are all human beings. I could also talk about my, you know, depression. That was a deep failure, you know, 50 years old and I made such a huge mistake. No, I think mainly I take it as a learning, you know, right? So people should also understand that the way they see the world, it's called paradigm, right? That paradigm can be shifted, you know, the way you were, you know, educated or trained or at home, upbringing, it can be shifted because there is a great thing called neuroplasticity. If you change, you know, the way you see things, you know, the things will change, basically, right? And this is it. And the major trigger of those issues is that we are not teaching enough people how mind works and so on. And it's, oh, guys, to be honest, 90% of the stuff is on internet, on YouTube now.
Yeah, and...
Are you familiar with the Khan Academy? Bill Gates was, you know, giving him some money. Saud Khan, you know, created like 15 years ago, right? It is a great tool, but still, you know, probably 250, 300 million kids are using it, not like 5 billion, you know, right? It's and it's on internet and it's free of charge, right?
Yeah, no, Khan Academy is a great tool for anybody who's a student.
Oh,
for sure.
Oh, you bet. Yeah, even yeah, like yeah, for people with the university degree.
Yeah, yeah. You know, so I think you're getting at an interesting point because most people, and again, we're generalizing here, their brain operates more kind of on default mode, which means, right, they focus more on weaknesses, they focus more on what's going wrong, etc. And this is why, you know, Josh and I have talked a lot about helping athletes develop their own personal philosophy of excellence, which, you know, giving them better ideas behind how they think. You could call that paradigms. I like to call it philosophy because I think that's cool. but oh, yeah, whatever yeah, you call it, right?
Michael Jaros, I know him also because he worked with Michael, so he calls it also philosophy.
Yeah, and it's really about you developing your own sort of, yeah. We'll put it in Microsoft terms, you're developing your own personal operating system, right?
Absolutely.
People don't, you know, people run applications on their computer, but they don't think so much about Windows or Mac OS. Those things aren't working well, then a lot of stuff doesn't work well. And it's very much how the brain is working also. And so a big part of how we succeed is developing those better ideas behind how we think. So my question is, I think a big part of that is, what is your definition of success overall, right? You know, I love the John Wooden definition. But I would like to hear, you know, how you work with your athletes to help them understand maybe a healthier definition of what it means to be successful.
Yeah. And, I think the most successful athletes are those who got deep emotional connection to what they do. They play by heart. Okay, that's one. When I was working with Bill Gates, almost for 10 years, you know, traveling, whatever, that was a great laboratory to study relationship between success and happiness, okay? Because I think happiness is a little bit, you know, more than the success. And I think the happier people are those who can make happy other people through something they love, okay? Which means we are going, if, you know, what you do, it's like the meaning of your, you know, life, right? Then that success, it's continuous. There is another great guy who used to teach positive psychology at Harvard, Tal Ben-Shahar, right? He wrote a book, Happier. Happiness is not one point, but happiness is the way, basically. That's what the Chinese were saying. So, the tool I'm using with athletes, but also with the business, you know, people, and it's published in the Positive Leader book. Three circles. First circle, your genes. Those are your talents, basically. Those are the talents. You can figure out Gallup test or, you know, do another test, whatever. So your, you know, talents. Then the activities you really like. It's almost like those are your talents. There is a metrics. The activities you like, those are activities which, you know, provided you are using your talents, are putting you in the zone, in the flow, okay? So, this is still about you. This is not yet about the other people. The third circle, it's about the other people. And that's the circle of your personal values. Because your personal values are reflecting things what you like with the other people, because we are social beings, right? So if you take like five people you admire, one thing per each and every person, those are your personal values. And when those three circles are overlapping, this is the meaning in your life. My meaning is unlocking human potential. That's a huge meaning. And I use it both like in the business sense, in the sports sense, and everything. And I really, you know, mean it, right? I think who is saying that? Somebody, you know, great speaker is saying always that success without the fulfillment is failure. And that's what I think it is. You need to be fulfilled. It needs to be like the meaning in your life. It means basically, if you are winning Wimbledon, it needs to be something more than just this, you know, nice cup, right? Because I think Novak Djokovic, tennis is like meaning. He likes tennis so much, you know, the same with Federer and Nadal, you know, right? So, this is it. I think meaning, again, right, two great books, you know, Viktor Frankl, The Man's Search for Meaning, that you can serve, if you have a meaning in your life, you can survive everything. And then the gentleman who was teaching us, unfortunately, he passed away, Clay Christensen from Harvard, wrote a book, How Will You Measure Your Life? Those are two great books which really influence, you know, me personally, how I was thinking about the meaning in your life. I think meaning is super important, you know. Also, like for longevity, if you have a meaning, you don't want to retire.
Yeah, I mean, I think that gets back to your mention of Martin Seligman, you know, and his model, exactly. Perma. Exactly. But if you, how you measure it is important, because not everybody has a great definition of success. Many, especially in a capitalist society, will measure by the size of their bank account. Others might measure it simply by wins, and those are not necessarily going to lead to meaning and fulfillment, and which I think is an important reason to work on that concept with athletes so that they can process it better.
And Brian, I think it's nothing bad to have a lot of, you know, money or grand slams. Absolutely.
Right. Yeah.
But you need to enjoy it. I think the key word is enjoy, you know, right? You need to like it. I mean, because look, Andre Agassi, he majority of the career, his career, he hated tennis.
Yeah.
Right. You read his book. It's amazing how he was open and honest. But then it changed because he took it like, hey, I need, you know, to play because I built this nice, you know, school for the less fortunate kids and so on. Then Steffi came, obviously, that helped also.
Yeah, so purpose was added on. Right.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, exactly.
No, I think I like that this discussion has gone in that direction in terms of purpose, because I think it gives people that reason why they do what they do. Right? If we're working so hard at it, we're dedicating so many hours to it, and there's those ups and downs. There's those ups and downs within and ups and downs within a career. Right? We win matches, we lose matches, we win finals, lose them, whatever. And I think that purpose is critical. So as we start to maybe, you know, tie some of these different pieces together, what is, you know, maybe one key tip that you can give people in terms of finding their purpose or finding sort of their reason why they do what they do?
Okay. Well, they should figure out, first of all, the nature. What are the talents? What are the hormones? What are the genes? Okay, and you can do some tests, or you can do another thing. You can put together some activities you really like, and those activities should give you energy. If it's talent, right, it should give you energy. You should learn fast. Okay, you should do it intuitively because it's your, you know, genes. You should, you know, improve as you go. You know, you should improve because talent is putting you a lot in the flow. And in the flow, according to the study from McKinsey, we are learning 450% faster. That's why if the athletes are able to even train in the flow, we call it in a sport, obviously, zone, and it's better. And last but not least, when you finish that, you know, work, that activity, you are looking forward to do it again and again and again, okay? The funny thing is, what is happening with, so you have some of those, you know, activities, and you're using them in different fields, right? The funny thing with the flow is that if you are in the flow, one of the first hormones which is released, it's endorphin, and endorphin is 100 times, you know, stronger than morphine. This is why you keep, you know, going. This is why if the player, you know, really feels like, hey, it's really, you know, I play by my heart. This is what, you know, Nadal is doing. Nadal is losing sometimes 2-0 in the final of, you know, Australian Open with Medvedev. I think it was a couple of years ago, if I remember correctly. And then he's still winning because it's, you know, endorphin battle, right? Right. So this is it. That's number one. Then the number two, what I would say is that people should go, like, really build this, you know, growth mindset, like every day better version of me. Because sometimes people go and like, I wanted to learn some foreign language, okay, at the beginning of January. But then it's gone. Unless you really create a process goals, like, you know, to build some, you know, knowledge of the foreign language. That means like 3 times to the, you know, language school every day, I will learn 5 new words and so on. That's why dopamine is released, and it goes like, dopamine is reward hormone. Dopamine is like rewarding you for the progress, but dopamine is motivating you to continue. And dopamine is very important hormone for us, right? So that's what I would say. And then that you can do that exercise, you know, talents, the activities you like, and what are your, you know, personal values, and start to think like that. What is really majority of the time, those things are giving you, you know, energy, and you can do it for a very long time. Kids, they know exactly what is putting them in the flow. They play with some toys. Sometimes they are throwing them in the corner, you know.
So that's probably a great way to wrap this up, is helping people discover their purpose, right? So thank you, Jan. What are ways that people can connect with you on social media, your website, et cetera? How can people you know, connect with your work and what you're doing?
I have a website, you know, janmuhlefe.com. That's both in my native language, Czech, and obviously in English. I'm on LinkedIn, you know, Instagram, Facebook, and on the YouTube channel, there's probably like 70% in Czech, 30% in English. So there's a lot of stuff. I have a colleague in Switzerland. We do every second week some live sessions, you know, so there's a lot of stuff. And then the books. The first book, Positive Leaders, like in 12 different languages. And now they are which is translated, and it will be published by the Winley, by the US, you know, publisher. It's a book, Unlocking Children Potential. What we were talking about, like, it's a lot of use by, it should be on the shelves in February next year. It's a lot about like what parents should do with the kids and coaches and teachers and so on. I think it's a really good book.
Yeah, no, it sounds absolutely fascinating, and looking forward to that coming out next year. So Jan, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a really very good and interesting conversation, and I know, you know, both of us enjoyed it.
No, Josh and Brian, thanks very much. And thank you for what you do, both for the, you know, tennis players and for, you know, the overall sport. And I really enjoy what you do in terms of the mental toughness and mental health. In fact, what we talk about today, because I think those topics are really important. Thank you. Yeah.
Well, that was an awesome conversation with Jan. I would say for me, one of my biggest takeaways, or maybe a highlight of the conversation, was when we talked about two different ideas that I think are very connected. One is when talking about the past and talking about how we need to be able to learn from the past. And he talked about, you know, some of his personal experiences, and he talked about, you know, his experience with depression and how, you know, how he connected that to, you know, being able to learn from our experiences. And, you know, I think it's interesting to think about how that connects to this idea of being able to, you know, really the necessity of being able to put things behind us, being able to put the past behind us so that we can stay present. So I think it was really interesting just hearing him talk about this idea of both, you know, learning from the past, but also being able to put it behind us so that we can be present and that we can, you know, really be in this moment, not stuck in the past and whatever has already happened. Because I think I think this can be true both in the micro and in the macro, right? In a tennis match, if we double faulted or we, you know, missed an easy volley and we're not able to put that behind us, then that impacts the next point, that impacts the present. And I think that's also true in life, right? Whatever's happened in the past, whether those are failures, whether those are perceived as failures, whether those are mistakes, whether, you know, it's bad luck, whatever it is, if we're not able to put those things behind us and learn from them, but also, you know, be able to put it behind us and move on, then we're not able to fully be engaged and present in this moment. So I really like that idea, and I think it's applicable both in tennis, but also beyond in life. So really enjoyed that aspect of the conversation.
And I think that connects well, Josh, with the idea that we discussed on being non-judgmental, and then Jan brought up, you know, the idea of not being attached to things. So it's always a tricky balance, though, of like learning from the past but not judging it. And there takes some, I think, skill and practice in how to do that. And that's why working with someone like Jan or a mental coach is helpful, because that person can bring some perspective about how do we talk about the past? How do we talk about what happened physically? How do we talk about what you are processing mentally and emotionally? So that you can get to a place where the past is not a thing of judging whether it was good or bad or a failure. Rather, it is a step forward, and how we learn from that and We discussed there how life is a lot like a tennis match. A tennis match is not over till it's over. Well, life isn't either. And so, you know, all of us are that work in progress, and we're not condemned necessarily by things we've done in our past. We can always somehow choose better, choose to be better, and move forward. So I thought it was, I thought it was a really interesting conversation. We went in a lot of different directions on things, but it was, in the end, it was really cool how we got to that purpose piece. And I think he's a fascinating guy, and I'm sure he's doing a lot of great work with some of the athletes that he's working with. And, you know, they're lucky to have him in their lives. So we want to thank Jan again for coming on the show, and want to thank all of you for listening. For more on today's episode, please check out the show notes. If you have any feedback or questions for me and Josh, please email us at tennisiqpodcast@gmail.com. Also, if you're enjoying the content that Josh and I discuss on the show, please rate and review the podcast so other tennis enthusiasts can find it more easily. Additionally, to be notified of new episodes, please subscribe to the show on your podcast platform of choice, including YouTube. You can also check us out on Instagram. If you would like to support the podcast, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/tennisiqpodcast/membership, where you can learn about the benefits of being part of the Tennis IQ podcast community. Thanks again, and we'll talk to you soon in our next episode.